Hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. We're on the second book, called 40,000 Miles Around the World. We're on chapter 15, and this is the 13th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 15. A Sad Recollection at Hobart, Running Too Long and Its Consequence, and The Albatross. Hobart is the capital of Tasmania and has a population of about 45,000 people. The city is picturesquely situated at the foot of Mount Wellington and on the River Derwent, about 12 miles from its mouth. Owing to its excellent climate, Hobart is visited during the summer by many holidaymakers from the Australian continent. The River Derwent and the Entrecasteaux Channel afford one of the most beautiful cruising grounds in the world, and many yachtsmen take full advantage of this. While staying at Hobart, as in other places, I received many invitations to afternoon teas, dinners, etc. One afternoon, having accepted an invitation from a young married couple, I was shown some photographs. One of them represented a bright-looking young man, and it struck me that I had seen his face before. The lady of the house, who had passed me the picture and stood beside me, said in a low voice, "Do you recognise this photograph?" And when I looked up into her face, I saw tears in her eyes. "I do," I replied. "It is a photograph of the young man whom I lost off the Tillicum on the night of October the 27th, 1901. "Yes," she said, "that young man was my brother." Both the young lady and her husband must have noticed that I also was moved by the sudden recall of that sad accident. They assured me, however, that they did not think in the least of blaming me. They knew that it was a very common occurrence to lose lives from much larger vessels. After a stay of a fortnight at Hobart, we sailed for the south end of New Zealand. I was advised by people at Hobart that I had better not take that course, as the weather most likely would prove too much for the Tillicum. But by that time, I was fully convinced that the boat was as sound as she had ever been, and I felt as comfortable in her during a heavy gale as in a calm. I had made up my mind, so we set sail on January the 27th and shaped a course for Invercargill, the southernmost city of New Zealand. The distance, as the crow flies, is about 900 miles. We started with a light westerly breeze and under a clear sky. The wind freshened up towards night and we soon got into the open Pacific. For the first 2 days, the westerly winds kept fresh and the Tillicum went along at her best. On the third day, the wind gradually hauled into the northeastward, and thereafter into the east. As I had reason to hope that it soon would haul into the westward, these being the average winds in that part of the world, I kept the boat on the port tack, thinking that in this way we would most likely secure a quick passage. But at the same time, we were carried more and more to the south and got down nearly as far as the 50th degree, while the wind still blew from the east. I then put her on starboard tack and stood to the northward. We always enjoyed a good strong breeze, just enough for the Tillicum to nicely put up with under all sail. Only at times during the night I shortened down. Having gone a few miles to the northward, the easterly wind became light and hauled into the westward, after which the force increased. I kept the Tillicum before it and steered for the south of New Zealand under all sail. Whenever a southwester comes in after an easterly wind in that part of the world, it very often develops into a gale, and so it did on this occasion. The wind continued blowing and the boat increased her speed as it got stronger. I took in one sail after the other until she was running under a mainsail only. I told my mate to put one shutter into the cabin door, as I intended doing a little sailing that afternoon. I do not like to press a small boat hard when sailing by the wind with a strong breeze and head sea on a long cruise, such as we were on, because the jumping and pitching and the heavy spray which the boat will take on board under those circumstances is anything but pleasant. But it is certainly a pleasure to sail a boat with a free wind or when she is running before it and has a good large sea in her favour. In running with the wind and sea, I could sit in the cockpit with the tiller in my hand hour upon hour, and just watch her going along. When running hard, I mostly use the mainsail only. Sailing of this sort is a pleasure, and it seemed so fascinating to me that afternoon that I would sit there not conversing with my mate, but talking to the boat after this style. That's right. Go it, good old Tillicum. Get to New Zealand quickly, and we will have a fine time there. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The wind was increasing and the seas getting larger, and I was thinking to myself about heaving too, when all of a sudden I heard the noise of a breaking sea coming up behind us. Hello, I said to myself, there it is. And by that time, the sea certainly was there. It turned out to be a bad one, and the boat was not quick enough to raise her stern to the occasion, so the sea broke over us. For a second, ship and crew were submerged. However, as we had one shutter in the door, very little water penetrated into the cabin. But whatever little did get in, it must have entered like a shot, for my mate said afterwards he had been sitting upright in the forepart of the cabin when the water splashing over the top of the lower shutter struck him in the face. My chronometer watch, which hung in the same neighbourhood near the deck, had disappeared from its place. I found some pieces of it later at the bottom of the boat, but apart from the watch and a few little things that got wet, there was no damage done. This sea was much larger than the one which took my unfortunate mate and the compass overboard, and only the lifeline which I had fastened to myself prevented me from going along with it. I managed to keep the vessel from broaching to when the sea broke over her, but of course, after that reminder, I hove to under sea anchor and riding sail. Owing to our southerly position, we had almost reached the 50th degree. The weather was rather cold, and as both of us had got somewhat wet in the operation, we lit our little swinging stove, which was something like the sea anchor, it never failed to do its duty in any kind of weather, to make a cup of coffee, which turned out to be, when finished, a number 1.5. The stove could also be utilised for warming and drying the cabin, and we soon had everything shipshape again. The gale proved to be one of the real old Cape Horners, accompanied as it was by a genuine breaking sea. Apparently the Tillicum enjoyed it very much, raising her body over the large seas with almost as much ease as the albatross, of which an ample number swarmed round us. These great birds seemed to take interest in the boat, probably because of the build, size and painting of the little vessel. There is no doubt that ever since the southern seas have been the home of the albatross, they have never seen a vessel of similar small size and curious form. They would glide close to the mast for hours, now and then describing a circle round the boat, and at the same time taking an investigating look at the figurehead, which very much resembled their own. Some of the birds would alight near and alongside our boat and face those large approaching seas with their white, foaming and roaring tops in the same manner as the Tillicum. But instead of riding every sea, as our vessel was obliged to do, the albatross on the approach of a bad sea would spread its white wings and, gracefully rising just high enough to let the breaker pass, alight again. This gentle seabird accompanied us all the way from Tasmania to New Zealand, and we felt sorry when we lost such company. The gale kept up its fury for 2 days and nights, after which the wind moderated, and when the large seas had lost their breaking tops, we hauled the sea anchor on board and swung the boat before the wind. Our chronometer was spoiled, but it was beyond doubt that our longitudinal position at that time lay somewhere south of the New Zealand coastline. I therefore decided to sail to the northward until we reached the latitude of the south end of New Zealand, whereafter a course was to be shaped for Solander Island. Chapter 16. Arrival at New Zealand, oysters and what they affected, and the city of the Max. The westerly wind soon settled into a steady breeze, and on the morning of February the 8th, we sighted Solander. Although the wind lightened considerably during the day, we found ourselves towards evening right alongside. This is a small island, about a mile in length and half a mile wide, with heights of 1,100 feet. It was too late that night to make Invercargill on account of the dangerous navigation on New River, on the bank of which the city is situated. We therefore sailed round Solander looking for ambergris, but there was nothing doing in that line. We observed no signs of the island being inhabited and aimed a few shots at the birds which were flying about in great numbers. At dark we shaped our course for New River, and at 3 o'clock next morning, when within about 5 miles of its mouth, we hove to and waited for daylight. After sunrise we sailed up the river, arriving at Invercargill about midday, with boat and crew in the best of condition. Invercargill is a well-laid-out little city with a population of about 15,000. I was assured by the people that no smaller vessel than the Tillicum had ever visited them, and both my mate and I received a very warm welcome. A day or two later, my mate came to me and said, "Skipper, last night I went into a pop and called for a glass of beer, for which I paid threepence, and with it they gave me free of charge 6 great, big, fine, fresh, juicy oysters on a half shell. Truly, this New Zealand must be a great country." We remained a few days at Invercargill and then went round to Bluff Harbour, about 8 miles distant, which serves as a port to the former place, New River being too shallow for vessels of greater draught. The small town situated on the south side of the harbour is Campbell, and I believe I am correct in saying that 24 hours after our arrival, everybody there knew us, and we in turn knew everybody in Campbell. Owing to the kind treatments we received, we stopped for a few days longer than we should have done, and when sailing, the crew of the Tillicum was presented with a number of bags full of great big fine fresh juicy oysters, which were in whole shell and, needless to say, after my mate's heart. Leaving Bluff Harbour with a moderate westerly breeze, we followed the coast towards Dunedin, a distance of about 120 miles. It is a pleasure, on a fine clear day, with a moderate breeze off the land, to sail along the beautiful seaboard of New Zealand, and to make it all the more enjoyable, we had oysters with every meal and a few between meals. My mate declared that he could slip down a dozen or two at any time. However, the fine breeze did not last. On the following day about noon, threatening clouds rose from the west, accompanied by a fast increasing wind. This proved sufficiently that a westerly gale was approaching. As we were then too near the coast to ride out a gale, and no harbour was at hand in which to take shelter, I altered our course to the south-eastward in order to gain sea room. Having managed to get clear of the land for about 15 miles, we were compelled to take in the last sail and heave to in the usual way. That night it blew very hard, and we must have been in a tide rip, for the Tillicum rolled and tumbled about much more than in previous gales. My mate complained of the oysters he had eaten for supper, saying that they were trying desperately to return to the ocean. I advised him to bite the heads off whenever eating oysters at sea, as I did, and then they were quite dead. "Bite their heads off," he said. I should say I did, and bit their legs off too, but something not quite a groan finished our conversation. The gale lasted for 2 days and proved to be one of the hardest blows that I experienced on the Tillicum. In fact, the tumbling about and the oysters made my mate so sick of the sea that he gave me notice right there and then that there would be no more Tillicum and oysters for him once he put his foot ashore again. 2 days later, we arrived at Port Chalmers, about 8 miles from Dunedin, where we remained for 2 days and then took the boat up to the latter place. This constitutes the Scotch city of New Zealand and the headquarters of all the Macs, such as MacDonald, MacPherson, Mackenzie and many others. And we certainly found the Macs to be all right, and so was Piper Gray, though not a Mac himself. The latter was the proprietor of the hotel at which I stayed, and the very night of our arrival he and some of the Macs resolved that I could not run about in Dunedin as a plain Voss. Consequently, my name had to be changed, and I at once was christened McVoss. If I remember rightly, it was Piper Gray who sprinkled the water on my head. I remained for 22 days at Dunedin. During that period, at the request of the city authorities, the Tillicum was removed on a wagon to the park to take part in a floral fete. There the ladies of Dunedin decorated her from her keel to the top of her 3 masts. When on March 25th I was obliged to tear myself away from the Max and Piper Gray, at the same time rechristening myself plain Voss, it also felt like leaving home. My only consolation was the old saying, "The best of friends must part." With Mr. G. MacDonald on board, who insisted on making a sea trip in the Tillicum and volunteered to go with me to Lyttelton, I set sail shortly after noon. Flags were flying all over the harbour, and thousands of people crowded the waterfront, waving handkerchiefs and hats and wishing us a safe voyage. We were taken in tow by a large river steamer, full of people, and accompanied by another passenger boat and a fleet of Dunedin yachts. We proceeded down the bay towards the ocean, a distance of about 11 miles. The wind blowing lightly, the yachts soon dropped behind, but the two steamers, with their decks crowded with passengers, escorted us all the way down. On arrival at the mouth of the river, a nice southeasterly breeze induced us to set all sail, so the steamer let go and the people on board gave us three hearty cheers, which we answered by three dips of our flag on the mizzen. Then the steamers returned upriver to Dunedin, while the Tillicum headed for the north. New Zealand had so far afforded me a splendid reception, more than I could ever deserve. But as I am one of those who can never get too much of a good thing, I made up my mind to enjoy that beautiful country as long as possible, and accordingly called in at nearly every port along the coast. The next morning after leaving Dunedin, we sighted Oamaru, a small town situated near the beach. Coming nearer, we saw an artificial breakwater, inside of which a large vessel lay alongside a wharf. Near that ship, I brought the Tillicum up, and as place and people looked inviting, we remained for a few days. Then we resumed our course northward and called in at Timaru, a town somewhat resembling Oamaru. After a short stop, we sailed for Lyttelton. The distance between the two places is only about 120 miles. But as we got mixed up in a northeasterly blow, we were compelled to heave to under a sea anchor for about 36 hours, and consequently it took us 3 days to make Lyttelton. On our arrival there, the Tillicum was transported by train to Christchurch, a distance of about 8 miles. Chapter 17. Christchurch, a practical demonstration. At Christchurch, many people came to inspect my boat. The first question, of course, was, how do you manage your tiny vessel in heavy storms? On one occasion, a gentleman asked me the same question again, and when I had explained matters to him, said, it is surprising indeed that you have come all the way from British Columbia and weathered all gales successfully in this little vessel. Only a few days ago, two friends of mine entered Sumno in a launch much larger than your boat. In crossing the bar, the launch was upset, and one of the two, a particular friend of mine, who only recently had returned from the South African War, unfortunately was drowned in spite of being a very good swimmer. The other was saved by the Sumno lifeboat. I then related my experience near Melbourne, where I was compelled to run the Tillicum for half a mile through heavy surf breakers, explaining how I crossed the breakers by having a sea anchor over the stern. Now, that gentleman asked me whether I was willing to repeat the same manoeuvre on the Sumno bar. I am certain, he said, the people of Christchurch would appreciate a practical demonstration, as we have had many accidents on the Sumno bar. I am always willing and ready to put into practice what I preach. I therefore agreed to give a demonstration before my departure from Christchurch. What kind of boat do you want us to use? He inquired. Any boat of, say, from 18 to 20 feet in length, I replied, and one that three men can handle. I will get a boat of that description for you. What day do you choose? Any time, I said, and we fixed the day on the spot. Crossing a breaking bar requires three men. Two must be at the oars while one tends to the sea anchor. Mr. MacDonald, who had sailed with me from Dunedin, had left the boat already to return to that city. However, he was still in Christchurch, and as he had told me when we parted that he would go with me again at any time and in any vessel, I notified him, and he readily volunteered. The second man was Mr. H. Buckridge, who had just returned from Captain Scott's South Polar Expedition on the relief ship Morning, and who had taken Mr. MacDonald's place aboard the Tillicum. We left Christchurch on April the 28th at 9 in the morning by a tramcar for Sumno, which is about 9 miles distant. On our arrival there, we went down to the beach to have a look at the boat which we were to use for the demonstration. It turned out to be an ordinary 18-foot fishing boat with a sharp stern. The weather was fine and the breakers running in towards the beach and over the bar were just about right to make things interesting both to the spectators and ourselves. The demonstration on the bar was to take place at 2:30 in the afternoon, but to get my two men into trim, I went out with them for a drill at 11 o'clock. The boat lay a short distance from Sumno in a quiet little bay. My mates took the oars and I sat down in the stern, holding the same sea anchor that had guided the Tillicum through several gales ready for instant use. We then rowed out into the open where long big rollers came running in. Steering round, we rowed towards the shore, where the rollers struck shallow water and with an overfalling top ran up the beach. Shortly before the boat entered the breaking seas, I dropped the sea anchor over the stern, and instead of reversing it, as I had done near Melbourne, kept it full, and slowly and safely we crossed the surf breakers. Just before the boat struck bottom, I brought the sea anchor aboard and we backed the boat towards the ocean. That, however, was not quite so easy, as great care must be taken to meet every approaching breaker head-on, and if a boat has got too much speed when meeting a comber, the latter is sure to break over her and most likely will send her to the bottom. On the other hand, if a boat in that case has not enough headway, it may be turned end over end. Therefore, it takes trained men to accomplish a feat of that sort. Both my mates were strong, able men, and knew how to pull an oar. I watched the approaching breakers and advised them how to pull, and thus we managed to bring the boat back through the surf, but not without shipping her half full of water. Having returned to the landing place, we changed our garments and went back to Sumno, where, to our surprise, we found the town already alive with people who had come from Christchurch, and still every tram running in was crowded. At the stated time, we manned our little boat again, and this time pulled in towards the bar. In coming near the breakers, we saw the beach crowded with people, and just when we entered them, a band concealed in the crowd on shore struck up Life on the Ocean Wave. Then we passed over the roaring and foaming breakers, only about 100 yards distant from the beach, while our 7,000 people, a figure given to me later on, waved their hands, their caps and umbrellas and handkerchiefs, shouting at the top of their voices, "Well done! Well done!" Having thus crossed the bar breakers, we got into smooth water, where the Sumno lifeboat lay with a crew of trained men on board, everyone with a life belt around him and ready to come to our rescue in case of emergency. Our demonstration did not end when we had crossed the bar only once. We desired to take another round trip to give the spectators something for their money, which they had spent on the tram from Christchurch. Crossing breakers seawards, as I have stated before, is much worse than coming in towards the shore, and on this occasion, as before, we did not succeed without shipping quite a lot of water. Nevertheless, after having reached the open and bailed out our boat, we stood in for the breakers again. When we were halfway across and in the worst of it, approximately 150 yards from the spectators, we stopped the boat's headway and let her lay to the sea anchor, and with the additional help of the oars, we kept her heading the breakers. The boat was then dancing up and down as the waves passed under her. One moment she would stand on her head and the next on her stern, but she was entirely out of danger. We in the boat enjoyed that sport very much, although in crossing the bar on our way out, we got thoroughly wet. We imagined that from the spectator's side, the operation must have looked somewhat monotonous. Therefore, in order to create some excitement and liven things up a little, Mr. Buckeridge, who was a first-class swimmer and diver, unobservedly tied a rope round his waist, the end of which I kept under control, and then simulated falling overboard. The moment he disappeared in the breakers, the yell came from every mouth on shore, "Man overboard!" The band stopped playing, the lifeboat crew came pulling along with all their might to the rescue. Buckeridge kept out of sight until the lifeboat was within about 50 feet of us, and then, pulling in the rope, I found him safe and sound at the other end of it. The people on shore applauded and hurrahed, and the lifeboat was taken back to the station, and the band once more tuned up a Life on the Ocean Wave. We rowed our boat towards the shore into smooth water, and after that we crossed and recrossed the bar once more, and thus successfully completed our demonstration. However, the best part of it, as far as the demonstrators were concerned, followed the next day, when the manager of the tramcar company presented me with a cheque for nearly £50. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.